To be honest, I don't know. But if something's that important, it's worth considering more than once.
Really? Well, in my experience, second thoughts are vastly overrated.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 269.
Nice.
For the week of September 23rd, 2019. I am snooty French chef David T. Cole, and I'm here with Sarah Bunting, Sarah D. Bunting.
What on earth am I doing here?
Crown jewel Tara Ariano.
Shine me up.
Antiquated way of life Joe Reed.
Oh, what shall we do?
And tea with a dame's tea spiller, Chris Vile.
John Plowright, what an asshole.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great 269.
Nice.
Yeah, I went back to the well. I had to. We are here to talk about Downton Abbey, colon, the movie. And of course, if we're talking about a theatrical release, who better to have on as guests than this had Oscar Buzz co-hosts Chris Vile and Joe Reed. Welcome.
Thank you. Guys.
Pew. So the Downton Abbey TV franchise now has a movie. Here's the plot summary in brief, and I will keep it pretty spoiler free for anyone who's still planning to see it because it just opened. The King and Queen of England are coming to Downton Abbey as part of a tour of Yorkshire. Carson is called out of retirement for one last job running the house because Mary doesn't think that Barrow can handle it. And there are, you know, a number of plots, of course, through the 2 hour length of it, but there are kind of three major plots. Number one, we're supposed to think people suspect Tom might disrupt the royal visit with some kind of Irish Republican statement, aka Pinko nonsense. Two, Robert's cousin Maud is strangely close with her maid and everyone wants to know what their deal is. And Thomas meets a guy. That's basically it, right? I mean, all of the other plots are kind of minor compared to those.
Tara, I thought you were gonna characterize the Tom plot as the look out itchy, he's Irish plot of the movie.
Also, point of order, she's the queen of the United Kingdom and Commonwealth, not England.
All right.
Well, look, you're going to get letters if you don't say it. Those royalists.
You're right. Dave is the only one here with a British passport, so he has the right to correct me.
Yeah.
Before we get into what everyone thought of the movie as a movie, I feel like we have to start with, does this movie had Oscar buzz, Joe?
Yes, in a very specific way. I don't think anybody's talking about this as like a best picture contender, but there are, I think, and Chris, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like there are two specific arenas people are talking about this as a possibility.
Ooh, can we guess?
Yes.
Okay. So actress for Maggie Smith.
Supporting actress, but yes.
Right. Supporting actress. Yes. And then costumes.
Yeah. That's what, Chris, right? Yeah. You would agree with this?
Yes, I would totally agree with that.
Sounds right.
Also, I mean, maybe a small asterisk on that, because for like any Oscar nerds out there, the makeup and hairstyling category is now going to be 5 nominees this year for like a movie that has a lot of period hairstyling and wigs. Who knows? But yes, it's mostly those two.
Okay.
I think especially when you're talking about like Maggie Smith, and there's certain like Oscar precursors that happen throughout the year, like it's worth it to remember that like the Screen Actors Guild has never been able to let go of Downton Abbey. Like they stuck with that show and kept nominating it for like ensemble awards, like through to the end. And
truly like, through to the end. And Maggie Smith was nominated every year except for the final season.
Right. Like it was, it was a lot. So they like, they love them some Downton Abbey. They love them some Maggie Smith. And I will say, I went and saw this on opening day, like the early matinee in Buffalo. I was still in Buffalo visiting my family. And like the people came out to see this, like every blue hair within like 100 miles. It was quite something.
Raising
it was best. Like lit for Buffalo at 1 p.m. It was a thing.
Well, the review of the three octogenarian ladies that were sitting next to me at the movie trying to make friends, which I did not, sorry, ladies, was that the Dowager Countess slayed every one of her lines. Mine was that it was exactly what a fan of the show would want it to be.
Right.
Joe, let's start with you. What is your big picture assessment of it as a movie?
I sort of walked in being like, all right. Like, I liked Downton Abbey, and I was sort of, but I was like, you know, TV shows should end. And yeah. I was, you know, sort of, my arms were a little bit crossed. And then the very beginning, like before we're through the credits, when they broke out the helicopter shot around Downton mm-hmm. Abbey, like they finally were just like, we got some budget. And yeah. they're like, they really were able to like show off the entire thing. And I was just like, okay, fine. Like, you got me there. That's pretty cool. Like, good for you guys. And, you know, it's like, you know, reconnecting with some old acquaintances, and it's nice to see some of these people again. I could not resist Salt and Pepper Thomas. Like, that was nice.
Yeah.
His whole storyline was the most that felt like it could have used a whole season, or at least like a few episodes to breathe, where they mm-hmm. really did put him through like flirting with two separate men and getting his job usurped by Carson yeah. and going to the gay speakeasy that suddenly exists in town and getting arrested and getting exonerated and dealing with like the privilege of the guy who got him out because he's got royal connections. Like, yeah. there's a lot to deal with, and mostly Thomas was just like, that was cool. And, like, that's not quite the Thomas that we know.
Right.
And I was happy that, like, nothing bad happened to him, because, like, that's, yeah. you know, better that if we're going to, like, breeze through it. But that was the storyline that I was just like, maybe, like, in the scope of a full season, we would have seen some ups and downs and have him sort of come out of it at the other end, you know, a little bit more of a hard-won appreciation. But
all right, well, you know. We'll come back to Chris last for reasons that will become clear. Sarah Bunting, yes. famous Sarah Bunting, what did you think?
Despite the fact that I was not in it,
I know.
I thought that it did exactly what it set out to do, and it reminded me of the Sex and the City movie, the first one. Mm-hmm. Stay with mm-hmm. me here, in that it was absolutely a like expert fan service super sewed.
Yeah.
And I have absolutely no problem with that. If we weren't talking about it today, I'm not sure I would have taken my ass to BAM to watch this. Joe,
thank you so much for your service. Your heart.
Oh boy.
Oh my God. But then it was like the familiar music cues at exactly the right places, Mosley-ing, which in the interim, that actor keeps showing up on like the British crime show series that I watch. And he's always like a fucking disgusting monster. And for him to be back in his livery and like basically doing a Donna Martin Texas dip, except he looks also like he's about to pee. Yeah. And may have been peeing. I mean, like, it was beautiful to look at. The Dowager C had all these satisfying lines. My first note was, excuse me, where's the dog butt? And my second note was, ah, there's a dog butt. Like, this is a very sort of familiar comfort food property, and it stayed in that lane, and I think that's great. Like, is it an A+ movie sort of outside of that? No, but for what it was trying to do and for who it's for, A+.
When you were talking about BAM, are you referring to the Brooklyn Art Museum? Is that what you were talking? Is that where you saw
Academy of Music?
Oh, Academy of Music. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
If they're not the worst audiences in New York City, they're in the bottom
like
three.
Full of poignant grunters, that kind of thing.
Oh my God. That's all they do. And late.
Yeah.
And yet I can't imagine a more appropriate venue to see this movie than some type of academy.
So many giant wooden necklaces, people. So many.
Not to take us too off track, but Sarah, do you remember seeing the diving bell and the butterfly
yes.
bear?
Yes. Oh,
and the
my
people
God.
Who tried to like climb over us in like the last half hour of it, they showed up that late.
Oh my God. We really should. I'm still waiting for our congressional medal, which we was cut in half like a beef right St. N's necklace. Oh my
Look,
God.
They were just really into diving bells and couldn't give a fig about butterflies. So they just came in late.
They came late.
That was infuriating. Thank
so
you.
Here's my take on this. I think they did a great job making me pay for what I usually get for free. And that is a credit to them.
Yeah.
I just wanted more of what I was used to. And if I have to pay for it, so be it. And I did. So well done. Me departing with $12 to see two episodes stitched together. And, you know, it was nothing spectacular. Like, yes, they had a little bit more money to spend on this and that. You know, if this was aired as a TV episode, I probably, you know, wouldn't have noticed that much. And just to attach to the, wow, Thomas had a lot to do. Wow, Tom also had a lot to do. He was like,
no,
he was in the spy game. He is thwarting assassinations. He is fixing people that are living in secret. And then he's the catalyst for fixing royal marriages. Like, oh, Tom had a lot to do this episode. Yeah. And he still had to deal with stealing cars or whatever the hell he's doing in town. So,
you know, right. Who had almost nothing to do? Mr. Bates.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, yeah.
Well, thank you for
continuation
that.
From the last, yeah. From the last, like, several seasons.
That wasn't a complaint.
I mean, what are they going to do? Like, you know, oh, no, I don't know, my arm's broken. Like, you know, there's only so many things they could do with Mr. Bates before you get to the point where he's just a punching bag for reals.
I did like once they got to the part where, like, everybody were going to play a prank on the royals. And it's just like, and that he and Anna were, like, the ringleaders, mostly because there was no other plot for to give to them. So yeah. They're just like, you guys do this. And it's like, okay,
yeah. Fine. Yeah. That's. One more thing that Dave said as we were leaving the theater before we move on to Chris was, Dave, you can say it. I won't say it for you.
I would, except I have no idea what we're talking about.
Dave's point was, when you get this much budget, what you do is like way more stunt casting.
Oh,
he was disappointed that the king and queen weren't like more recognizable. Yeah,
right.
Faces.
Like, where's Judi Dench and, you know,
yeah.
Like, right.
Yeah. Peter Capaldi. I don't know who they are.
Colin Firth.
I just imagine Imelda Staunton like running out of the room with like arms full of cash, just being like, I got it.
All right. So, Chris, you are the least familiar with this franchise of all of us. What did you think going in cold?
By least, you mean not at all.
Oh, excellent. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Oh, rubbing my hands.
I knew it as a thing that exists that people love Maggie Smith for, but I had never watched the show. And okay, I do have a question because I saw it early at a press screening and I don't know if this was attached to the movie or not, but did you guys have that like 20-minute reel that catches you up with all of the characters before the movie started?
No.
We saw it at the Alamo, which has had their own sort of comedic version of it, but certainly not an official
one. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So we had a reel that was like hosted by two of the characters that were like two of the funny characters. So it was kind of like glib with all of this like backstory for these characters, including all of their tragedies, that it was like, well, and then this man died by having a car flipped on top of him. Wasn't that terrible? She got raped. Wasn't that bad? And so my mind is already a little bit blown and like shocked by what was happening. And the rest of the movie was quite strange for me. I wasn't expecting to take a detour into a gay bar. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, like, I could not necessarily follow who anybody was in this movie.
Or, well, there's like, 500 characters, so that's
there's 500
surprising.
Characters. They're all indistinguishable white people that you can only tell apart between if their clothes are expensive or not. And, yeah, I don't know if, aside from, you know, the whole plot device of, like, let's do a prank on basically the royal staff, if there was really anything that moved the dial for me. Even like, if you want to consider this like a supersized episode, like you're just watching an episode of something, I don't think maybe even 10% of these characters feel like they have a character arc even on an episode basis for me.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So I do think that this is like, I am not the audience for this movie, having not watched the show.
I had no idea you're coming into this so cold. I think it's hilarious that we made you watch this movie and you had not watched an episode of the show.
Ice cold.
I feel like it's almost punishment because like there is so much going on with all these characters from the show that, you know, just carries on. But if you don't know these characters, oh my God, this movie must be so boring. Like it's
again, I mean, like there's some stuff that I think is legitimately strange in this movie that, you know, kept me whelmed the whole time. But I don't know. I don't know. I mean, yeah, this is meant for Downton Abbey fans and people who haven't seen it. You might be lost.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like if we made you watch any of the like Christmas specials, which is basically this is like the last season's Christmas specials.
Yeah,
sort of
yeah
the
totally.
Same sort of feature concept. You know, instead of going on holiday in Scotland, it's the king and queen are coming. Oh no.
Yeah.
Yeah. You would be similarly thoroughly confused and nonplussed.
It's like that in the extreme a little bit too, because it almost felt like fan fiction, being somebody who hadn't watched the show. So it like it didn't feel like it, what's the phrase? Like, is this canon or not? This felt very not canon.
The show is extremely, I don't want to say fan servicey, but it is very, the characters sort of go on loops, right? You know, like each character has something, they have something that triggers them or sets them back, and then they are met to overcome that, whether it's the Dowager Countess and her machinations coming back to get her. Each character seems to have one of those. So nothing about the movie seemed untrue to the characters. It just seemed all very, very familiar ground. That's all.
Yeah. Well, I have some Pinko notes, but I can hold those off until later. Or
there's
not
a lot of that material, though. Like watching this movie after, like post Brexit, is a very different experience than watching old Downton Abbey, I feel like, right?
Speak on that.
Well, so like there was always the sense of that we were watching Julian Fellowes's sort of ode to the way he wishes things were,
or at least
like being a very, very sort of sympathetic to the, you know, the class striations in England and, you know, what's the right word? Just like the sort of the generosity of the upper class to even, you know, be nice to the lower class was always sort of presented in a way that like you're asked to applaud it a little bit. And
yes,
you get that again here, too, where just like, wow, Mary is so nice to Carson, like all the time. Although I will say Mary was a goddamn busybody in this entire movie and like Mamie needed to mind her own business a little bit. And I get it where like your husband, you know, your super hot husband is in Chicago. And like I get that, like, there's a void in your life because of that, but just like let Thomas do his job for God's sake.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then she said at the end, so it all sort of gets wrapped up for me is when Mary's talking to the Dowager Countess about, you know, should we even keep Downton? Is this way of life going away and yada, yada, yada. And she needs the, like the pep talk of like, it's worth keeping these old royal houses because reasons. And, but the one point she said, I just want everything to stop being such a struggle.
Yeah,
and
I wrote was that like, down too.
Ooh, ooh, does that land? Like that would have landed poorly anyway, but like, especially now, just like Jesus Christ. Yes. Yeah, such a struggle for y'all.
100%.
But also in the TV show, I thought they sort of settled the fact that Mary was going to be the steward of the Abbey and the township already.
Right. And yeah, she's already gone through this crisis.
Yeah. And it was like, they just reset that? Are they ignoring that? Like, it was already established that she was going to be head honcho moving forward and that she was, you know, if not enthusiastic for the responsibility, resigned to it.
Yeah.
Well, and not only that, but she has to get that pep talk from her grandmother. And then she also makes Anna tell her the same thing.
Yep.
Like, it's gross. I mean, the grossest thing about the show kind of has been the premise resting on the viewer believing that these people love working for the Crawleys. They feel like they're part of the family. And then the movie makes that even worse by having class warfare between people who are in the same class, like having the Downton staff be in a war with the Royal Advance team.
Fighting like, to change the bedpans of the king and the queen.
Exactly.
Jesus,
like this is what you're fighting for to get to like dish them out their mushroom puffs. What the fuck?
But also having the most outspoken advocate of, you know, the people's place in the new order being the ditziest, dumbest
fucking Daisy. Yeah.
You know, like that doesn't help.
Oh, Daisy.
Yeah, the other thing, and just for context, there's a glancing mention in the movie of this general strike that has just happened and that it's part of the reason why the king and queen have made this visit in the first place. So I looked it up. It was a 9-day strike in 1926, the year before the movie is set, to attempt to force the government to prevent wage reductions, which in that time had gone like almost had been cut in half over a course of 7 years. So like considerably. And there were lockouts for 1.2 million coal miners, but 1.7 million tradespersons also went on strike in solidarity at this time. The government was prepared. They had scabs, which is why the strike only lasted 9 days. But even so, it's considered a brilliant failure because of the way it cemented labor solidarity in the region, according to Wikipedia. And of course, like Yorkshire is definitely a center of coal mining labor, you know, issues because that was the big industry then. And especially at this time, it was like in crisis because there were so many more coal producing countries that could export them. So obviously I know the focus of the show isn't on workers outside the house, duh. But I also like having this one line happen and then also having to sit through like 3 pages of exposition of fucking Julian Fellowes showing off how much research he did about like the Royal Advance team coming to the town. It's like, it feels gross being implicated in his agenda sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, stop making me find this delightful Julian Fellows. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Meanwhile, I just sat there like, what? I couldn't even wrap my head around any of that.
Yeah, like Succession and Downton Abbey, obviously very different shows, but Succession doesn't try to make you think that the people that are like cleaning up Kendall Roy's shit from his bed, like, love it.
Right, right, you know? Exactly.
Anyway.
Chris, so going into this totally green, may I ask, what were your impressions of Maggie Smith as the Dowager Countess? Like, was that something that was delightful or annoying or somewhere in between for you?
I mean, she was fine. Yeah. Yeah, like, I get it. But, like, I think maybe it's overblown.
Yeah.
But I also felt like she probably got better material in the show.
Definitely. That's going to be my point. Yep.
I mean, I will also say, because most of her stuff is with Penelope Wilton, I was way more into Penelope Wilton, who's her sister. See, I couldn't even get baseline relationships. So, I mean, I was more taken naturally with the character actress next to the star.
The two of them have always been a good comedy team.
Yeah.
They did really take the plot shortcut of having her figure out the whole secret daughter plot between scenes.
That, oh my God.
You could really feel the contraction there, where it's just like, well, we need to move this along. So how about you just figure it out? Okay. Okay.
Yeah. But nothing led up to that. I felt like that was true of all of the mini storylines, except for the Thomas one, where it's just like all of a sudden we're jumped forward and stuff is happening.
Yeah.
I was fine with it.
Did you figure it out? Because I didn't.
I thought they were a couple. So
that's what I thought too. Yeah.
That would have been better.
Yeah.
It would have made the movie even gayer.
Yeah.
Different acting choices might have clarified that for the audience, but that's fine. And, you know, naturally, Tom is catnip to the lady. So
sure.
He finds love. And everything's going to be fine. And Downton stays in the family. Like, there are myriad legitimate complaints here, but I just keep coming back to the fact that, like, I don't know, like, if you didn't watch the show and sort of don't care about this kind of thing, that's completely fine. And I get it. And this movie is not for you, but I have to salute it for doing what it set out to do.
I agree. I shouldn't say, like, I don't mean to act like I didn't enjoy it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, same here. Yeah.
Yeah.
If I wasn't thinking about it critically for the purpose of this podcast, like, it would have been a total joy. But,
well, and it sent me back down a Royal Research Google hole again, which Tara also disappeared down. And we were calling to each other from neighboring research holes about various Princesses Mary. So, yeah, good times.
Yeah.
I don't want to, like, poo-poo on the movie too much, because clearly it is not for me, as someone who hadn't watched it. But, like, the ways that it could have been for me weren't as fully satisfying as it could have been. Like, a movie with this many actresses just sitting in rooms talking to each other, I should probably like more on a base level than I did.
Yeah.
And, like, that, it's just kind of... Even, like, it's not that it's, like, more placid and, like, even-keeled, but I don't know. I feel like I should have been more excited by what I was watching.
One of the elements that was missing from the movie versus this series is a lot of the times there are squabbles downstairs between the people that work downstairs. And in this one, they were sort of all united against the evil enemy that was the royal staff coming in to cook and clean and make beds. So some of that tension was gone. And, like, there were some good moments between, you know, butlers and footmen and stuff like that. That is not in this movie. Not that it was going to make a huge difference to you, but I felt like that was one thing that the movie didn't have in common with the series. It sort of, like, homogenized the downstairs staff in a way that was a little unusual for the series, because there seems to be always tension down there in this series.
Nice.
It's time to go around the dial talking about something we're watching on TV these days. First up, Tara.
I watched three CBS sitcom pilots. First, ever since I belatedly started watching Mom, I've been weirdly bullish on CBS sitcoms, even though I never watch any for, like, more than a couple of episodes except for Mom. But I did try with three, and Dave and I watched these this weekend in the order of which I thought would be least bearable to most bearable, and I think I was basically right. So let's start with Carol's Second Act. This is the multicam with Patricia Heaton. She's a former science teacher who's gone to med school after a divorce and is now an intern in her late 50s. And the whole thing is she has different kinds of intelligence from the 20-somethings, or I guess they might be 30, in her intern class, but she still has to learn, like, hospital rules and blah, blah, blah. The only other person in this, two other people you would recognize, maybe three. Lucas Neff, who was on Saving Hope and more recently an American Princess, is turns out to be very privileged. He's a medical legacy. They give him a he-him pronoun joke in his, like, first scene, so it's that kind of show.
Yeah.
He's fine, but I would like an oral history of, like, Lucas Neff, the person, and Patricia Heaton, the person, avoiding each other on set, because if you've seen either of them on Twitter, you know they do not share politics. that's an understatement. Kyle MacLachlan is also there as, like, the chief of medicine or something, some higher up.
I think that sentence could have ended at Kyle MacLachlan is also there.
Yeah.
He's there. He's not doing anything, but he's there.
No, he's the obvious eventual love interest for Carol that they're setting up, I think. And Ashley Tisdale from High School Musical is Carol's daughter that all the interns have a crush on. It's fine. It's not offensive. It's just not that compelling. And there are way too many characters with storylines to service. Dave, what did you think?
Totally forgettable. And, you know, it is another one of those CBS sitcoms, just like all the other ones you expect from CBS, except this one seems to be even, like, cheaper. Like, yeah. I guess because it's set in a hospital, they felt they had to use all the lights all the time. But it is so bright and unforgiving. It looks like it almost moves into that early videotape look where it's, like, too bright. The lights are like too glowy. It was like a weird production choice. Never mind the fact that it is, like, just not funny, period.
Yeah, there's a like turning a shower knob by mistake and getting drenched in your clothes joke. Like, it's the pilot, like, leave yourself somewhere to go. Next, Bob Hart's Abishola carries on the CBS sitcom tradition established by Shit My Dad Says of CBS sitcoms with titles that you can't really say out loud. But this one's also set in a hospital half the time. The lead Bob is Billy Gardell from Mike and Molly. He comes to the hospital because he's had a heart attack. His nurse is Abishola, played by, I'm going to try it, Folake Olafeyeku. That's terrible. She's Nigerian. He falls in love with her at first sight. He runs a family sock business, and his family is Christine Ebersole, Matt Jones, also from Bob and Breaking Bad, and Mary Beth Monroe, who's the medium place Mindy from The Good Place. It's all in Detroit. She also, Abishola has a family too. She lives with her aunt and uncle, and she has a kid. She also has a work friend and a bus friend. Again, why is this cast so big? Like, this is too many people. You know, like, sometimes there are episodes of Friends and there are only six of them where you're like, really? You have to have a whole subplot of Rachel reading a self-help book, but okay. This is like 10 people. It's too much. And I'm never mad about trying to tell stories about immigration, but I don't necessarily think this one is very ambitious. Dave, your thoughts?
The cold open ended or almost ended on a fart joke in an ER room. So I think that kind of tells you how much thought was put into this series, which is, you know, not a lot.
Yeah. This is another Chuck Lorre joint.
Boy.
Finally, The Unicorn. Well, so is Mom. The Unicorn. Walton Goggins is not playing Uncle Baby Billy from The Righteous Gemstones. Alas, he is here, Ward, a widower of a year with two young teen daughters. He seems to be doing basically okay until their freezer that has somehow stayed full of condolence casseroles for a year runs out, and then he kind of falls apart, and his friends decide that means it's time for him to start dating, which is it? Anyway. There's two couple friends. The better known ones are Michaela Watkins and Rob Corddry. And in this case, what the unicorn means is that because he's been married for a million years and, like, hasn't been sleeping around and doesn't have a wife who is still in the picture, he's like a unicorn for dating site purposes. He would be, like, very highly in demand. And it's
weird.
He gets busted on a date because she sees the tan line on his ring because he's only recently taken it off. And then he gets tons of sympathy benefits. People send her drinks, which grosses him out. And it's hard to tell given the series title. But my impression was that the events of the pilot make him recommit to being a good dad before he tries to add anything else to his life, which is good because, like, every time anyone tries to do, like, it's Sex in the City for men, like, it doesn't work because no one wants to watch straight men trying to fuck. It's gross. You know what I mean? It's not the same because of patriarchy. Entourage is the exception that proves the rule, I guess. But none of this one takes place in a hospital, although Watkins is a doctor. With only 5 opening credits cast roles for adult, this one feels luxuriously roomy compared to the other two. But this is also the best of the three, also the only single cam show. And Goggins is very winning as a dude who doesn't get how sexy he is to women. The girls who play his daughters are good and not, like, precocious and cloying. And this is probably the only one of these I would at least watch one more episode of. Dave.
Yeah, it was okay. I mean, given the talent on screen, I thought it would either be funnier or have more dramatic oomph, because it's not quite a sitcom, right? It's a dramedy. It's on the sitcom side of a dramedy, I guess. It just felt like they were pulling back sometimes, you know, like it needed a little more fire in its belly. But that might be, you know, just a symptom of pilotitis, you know, so
for sure.
I guess you'll have to check out episode 2 and 3 and see where they go. But certainly the most promising of the three.
Yeah. For my plug, again with this, has gotten around to the Melrose Place episode where Kimberly shows up. Thank God. So I'm hoping this means we're about to turn a real significant corner on that show. But if you have not been keeping up, please join us at Again With This, the podcast on Melrose Place, Beverly Hills 90210, and the reboot BH 90210, which Sarah and I co-host.
I'm going to glom on to your plugs to say that on Patreon this week, we're doing another new format from Sarah D. Bunting. This week, we're doing the post-Buffy the Vampire Slayer actor / staff power rankings. What have they done since? And, you know, where do they go? So we got 11 players. We rank them, give them inverse points, and we see who is in the top. We see who is in the bottom. And we have a lot of discussions along the way. We just recorded it just before the show. So
yeah, it was fun.
It was a good one. Thank you, Sarah. All right. Now it is time to move on to Mr. Joe Reed.
Thank you. So I had my eye on this upcoming show called Unbelievable for a while because it was going to star Toni Collette and Merritt Weaver, two of my favorite actresses, and also Caitlin Dever, who is a young actress who we have talked about, I feel like, on this show a lot, back to like the Justified days, back to the golden
That's
age
who
of Justified.
It is. Thank
That's
you.
That's exactly who it is. Yes. So she's been a fave for a while, and I kind of lost track of it. Netflix didn't do a whole lot of promotion for the show, and it kind of got lost in the shuffle. And then all of a sudden I saw people on my my social feeds talking about the show, and I realized that, right, because the title's not great, right? It's sort of a generic, you know, word, unbelievable, whatever. I watched it. It's fantastic. It's one of the better television shows I've seen all year. It's sort of a bummer that it aired in the summertime, and it might be sort of old news when it comes to Emmys next year. I know that was a problem with Sharp Objects, but like, regardless, if you haven't seen it, see it. It's only 6 episodes.
It's eight episodes.
So whatever it was, I was like, I wanted more. It's, Lisa Cholodenko directed most of the episodes. She's from The Kids Are All Right and Olive Kittredge. And most of the episodes are written by Susanna Grant, who, among other things, wrote Erin Brockovich. It is the story of these two police detectives, played by Toni Collette and Merritt Weaver, who are investigating a series of rapes and sexual assaults in Colorado that seem to have a similar MO, and they had been investigating opposite ones, and they figure out that they're after the same person, so they pool their investigation. The actual pooling of the investigation is actually really interesting and really good, watching the processy stuff between them, because as detectives, their demeanors are very much not what we're used to getting from a lot of these sort of, you know, I'm in too deep police detective shows where, you know, I've been investigating all these horrific crimes and it's changing me, and that kind of true detective thing. And it does, like, investigating all these horrific crimes is changing them, but it's not in this way where it's just like I tumble down the darkness of my own mythology. It's like, no, they're incredibly empathetic characters, even as they are sort of Toni Collette's the spikier, sort of harder edged one, and Merritt Weaver has, you know, she's a religious person and she's, you know, younger and trying to make her way, but they both have a lot of issues in terms of like being women running teams. I think there's a few moments where it feels like we're being asked to sort of evaluate them and like, are they nice enough as bosses? And then just like the show kind of blows right past that kind of stuff. Yeah. And at the same time, the other half of the show is on a different timeline in Washington State. Caitlin Dever is a rape victim who is dealing with the fact that she went to the police, and the police were very quick to jump at alternate stories to not believe her account of what happened. She's a foster kid. There's a lot of stuff. Elizabeth Marvel plays a foster, one of her foster parents. Bridget Everett plays another former foster parent of hers. And there's a lot of issues in terms of like why people aren't believing her, and then what happens to her because of the fact that she ends up recanting the claim, and her life just sort of goes to hell. And you spend the entire sort of series praying that these two storylines will match up together, because you know what great cops Toni Collette and Merritt Weaver are, and what great people they are, and that they will. These are the people that this girl is looking for. And it's harrowing in that way, but it's also just like really good, compelling, solid TV, like impeccably acted and really well written. And just watch it. Don't listen to me. Just go see it. I don't know if any, Tara, I know you watched it.
Based on great reporting from ProPublica too.
Have similar thoughts, different thoughts?
I did. I will limit my comments to other than to agree with you, because I know Sarah D. Bunting is covering it this week on The Blotter Presents with Annabeth Chow.
Indeed.
Oh, fantastic. All right. Well, I will eagerly look forward to that.
And agree with everything you said. Yeah, it's an amazing procedural that is emotionally truthful and doesn't do anything that it doesn't need to do. And we talk a lot about it and about how Merritt Weaver is the new voice of God.
Love her. I swear to God. I genuinely, she's one of those characters in this show where like within 7 words of her performance, you're just like, oh, I love you. Like that's mm-hmm. just it. Just like, I will follow this character to wherever.
Just her reaction to that guy who was at a crime scene being like, that's fucked up. And she's like, yes, it is. Like yeah. There's just yep. a novel in there. She's amazing.
Yeah. And the casting too. And I won't give away anything, but like every like 30 or 40 minutes you go by and like they'll introduce another character who's played by a familiar actor, and it's just so delightful each time when like these yep. different people sort of start showing up. And yeah, the casting of it is phenomenal.
Yep, it's great.
What do you got to plug there, Joe?
For my plug, I am still managing editor at primetimer.com. Come by. Sarah's got something going up this week about the return of Law and Order SVU.
Yeah. Doesn't show well against Unbelievable. I'll tell you that for free.
No.
Tara's been writing. Chris has been writing. I feel like we've got a really strong team of freelancers there, doing some really, you know, good work that I'm very proud of. So check it out, primetimer.com. And of course, well, you know, between Chris and I, we'll make sure that you all know to go listen to our podcast, This Had Oscar Buzz, which is great.
All right. Sarah D. Bunting, what do you got?
Since Smooth Joey Apollo is here, I thought I would do something a little sportsy. I'm going to talk about the 30 for 30 about Dennis Rodman, which is called Rodman for Better or Worse. It actually aired a couple weeks ago, but I just got around to watching it the other night. A few of the recent entries in 30 for 30 films series, like they're good. I'm never like annoyed or bored while I'm watching them, but they seem a little strained as to form and like the length of what they're mm-hmm. doing. Like they're trying to get it to an hour and a half TV time or 2 hours or an hour, whatever it is. And they seem a little overproduced. I will freely admit that I think that after OJ Made in America, it's going to be really hard for me to come to these movies just and accept them as what they are, which can never be that
right
astounding thing. But like The Good, the Bad, and the Hungry, which is about competitive eating and Joey bag of hot dogs. Yes. Dion's Double Play. Like Dion's Double Play should have been really good, but unfortunately it's sort of like treading some of the same ground as the You Don't Know Bo episode. And this one is just like, there's way too many filmmaking conceits happening. Like, Jamie Foxx is, you know, he doesn't suck at his job. I'm happy to have him narrating, but like, why?
That's who that was. I was trying to figure it out. I couldn't do it. Thank you for
putting me out of my misery. So if you're a Rodman super fan, great, but you're an executive producer, like maybe leave it at that and find some other way to get over your breakup with Katie Holmes. Like, he's fine. But there's also like all this this opening sequence where he keeps going through doors and that, you know, reenactor and like the costume changes. And I'm like, okay, Dennis Rodman's actual story, which was completely new to me as far as anything that took place prior to Celebrity Rehab. Yes, that is a sentence that I just said. Mm-hmm. Yes, Dad, I will write you a check for my college education. I am sorry. It's actually very affecting, and it makes so many things about Rodman's entire life and persona make sense.
Yeah.
That you don't need the weird, like, commercial parodies and door dissolves. And then sometimes it, like, disappears up its own ass with these animations and then rushes through other parts. Like, his prodigious alcohol consumption and the deleterious effects of it, of him abusing it. Like, it's fucking serious, and it's tied to visits to North fucking Korea.
Right.
Maybe don't blitz through this like you're more interested in the outfit he wore on the plane. It's just, it's very weird. But there's good information in here, and he is a heartbreaking figure. I'm not going to go to the word tragic like the film does, but I feel for this giant beef facial ringed man. I will also add that I would like John Sally to do talking head interviews for any documentary. I don't care. Planet Earth, My Cat from Hell. His ability to pull it. No, face is just like, it's almost without peer. But other than that, it's fine. It's worth checking out, but you can fast forward through the first 5 or 10 minutes. And I don't know. Like this, I feel like the filmmaker, I knew the filmmaker's name and I had to look it up, and it's Mr. Terry Lipinski, which I'm sure has nothing to do with anything, but I was just like, I'm not sure the NBA is your jam.
Get it.
That's the other problem, like Celtics versus Lakers. Just don't do any more about the NBA. That is a perfect movie. Okay, so speaking of things that are not quite perfect, but we hope you'll give them a try anyway, Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs is going to do a live taping. It is November 7th of this year at the Van Brunt Stillhouse in beautiful Red Hook, Brooklyn. You can get your tickets at mastass.eventbrite.com. There will be a link in the show notes. We hope that we will see you there. If we can't see you there, we may figure out a way to live stream it. Stay tuned.
Oh, boy.
Mr. Chris File, what do you have?
All right. So this episode, we were here to talk about Downton Abbey, which was a TV show into a movie. My show, it works in the opposite direction. It was a movie. Now it's a TV show. It's been on Netflix for a hot minute. It is Dark Crystal: Age of Resistance. I know there's some listeners out there that are probably weirdos like me that grew up being terrified of the Dark Crystal, the Jim Henson like puppet. Well, they're aliens. It's not planet Earth. It's Thra. But like, you have the Gelflings, which are like these weird little like fluffy long-haired twink people, and then you have the Skeksis, which are like birds that wear these ornate like Elizabethan but like run through the mud costume.
The Skeksis are what, like, you know those drawings people make, like what if a cartoon was real life? That's like the Skeksis are somebody drew Gonzo as something in real life, and
exactly, but then like got him addicted to meth.
Yep.
That is what a Skeksi is. And it's absolutely fucking terrifying when you watch this movie. But like, it was all done through Jim Henson Studio, so it was all done with puppets. So it's incredibly strange on top of being like scary and like a fantasy piece that's inspired by Tolkien, where it's like very like archetypal good versus evil. Anyway, the show is a prequel about how the Skeksis essentially depleted the resources of the planet Thra and killed off all of the species. But it's on Netflix, so it's got this real like sense of a glow up. Luckily, it's still with puppets, though, so it's very true to the original, while at the same time, it looks incredibly expensive versus the movie that looks like they maybe spent $5 on it, even though, like, some of it's gorgeous. Anyway, like, one thing that I really loved about watching about this, and as Joe mentioned, I've written for Primetimer, I wrote about the show for them as well, and... one thing I loved about it is that it makes something that it was originally very quite niche and weird into something that's incredibly accessible that works in the framework of like the Lord of the Rings films and like very stylized to what we appreciate about fantasy storytelling now in a contemporary context, but it still remains very true to the show, to the original movie. But yeah, it's great for all you weirdos out there. And if you want, like, but at the same time, I think it's a really fun show that, like, in like the mass of just like shit that's on Netflix, I think it's probably one of their most deeply strange original programming. Wow. But at the same time, very fun. And also, the voice cast is truly bizarre. It's like a bunch of famous people. You have like Oscar winner Alicia Vikander voicing a Gelfling prince that gets killed in the first episode. You have like Awkwafina plays a Skeksi. Harvey Fierstein plays a Skeksi. Wow. Taron Egerton is the hero. It's like Keegan-Michael Key, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, Lena Headey. Wow. The voice cast of this is absolutely insane. I have no idea. They truly, if you want evidence of like the type of money Netflix just has to shit away in all directions, don't look at the more like popular shows. Look at Dark Crystal: Age of Resistance and see the money that they spent on this very niche product that still, like, I think regular viewers can enjoy. And like, just look at the famous people that are attached to it.
Does the Harvey Fierstein monster dude sound like Harvey?
Oh, absolutely.
Awesome.
And then
that's
like
amazing.
The Awkwafina one, which Awkwafina is actually really funny on the show. She plays a Skeksi that has like a nasal problem and is just like snotting everywhere. But it's also Awkwafina, who already has a harsher sounding voice, doing a Harvey Fierstein impersonation. Wow. It's wild and it's authentically entertaining.
That's like that it's creepy because there was no part of the movie when I watched it as a kid that didn't creep me out. Even like the golden retriever monk dudes, they kind of freaked me out just because they were so like weirdly, you know, the motion was so off and they're just oming through their whole lives.
Yeah, they do that low chant.
The woman with the eye that she can pop out and look around. Like
the Agra? Yes, she is back. The like most beloved character of the original, the Agra, is a main character in this as well. She's like, she looks the same age, which just tells you she's 2 million years old.
She's the Dowager Countess of Dark Crystal.
She truly is.
I feel kind of obligated to check it out now after that rundown of everything that's going on in there. Thank you, Chris. What do you have to plug there?
As Joe mentioned, we both co-host the This Had Oscar Buzz podcast. This week, we've talked about Renee Zellweger in Miss Potter, the Beatrix Potter biopic. We've had Tara on before to talk about The Family Stone. I also write regularly for The Film Experience. Catch me there, too.
We'll link all your stuff in the show notes.
He doesn't like you. He's grumpy as can be. He doesn't like fun. That's plain to see. Time to ask, will Dave hate this?
Probably.
So, NBC's new streaming service, which we now know will be called Peacock, because
nice. That's not a bad name.
No one at the company ever was in middle school, I guess.
That's a fine name.
They should have just called it Ding Ding Ding.
Ding Ding. Okay, that's better.
Anyway, they're getting a new take on Battlestar Galactica from Sam Esmail, creator of Mr. Robot and EP and director of Homecoming. That is, as of when I did this write-up last week, basically all we know, and I haven't seen anything new since. Esmail tweeted the day of the announcement that it will not be a remake of the amazing series at Ron D. Moore launched, because why mess with perfection? Instead, we'll explore a new story within the mythology while staying true to the spirit of Battlestar. So say we all. Sarah,
Dave will hate this. Like, I think my argument begins and ends with the title Mr. Robot. I will elaborate slightly, but do I need to? Probably not. Esmail et al.'s tendency to disappear up his own ass and into like actual fifth dimensions may be actually indicated for this material, but it got out of control enough with Mr. Robot, even for me, and I liked the show, that especially since he liked the most recent version, I don't think this is going to be Dave's jam, and I respect that they're not trying to redo the Rondi Moore version, but then, like, why are we here? Like, isn't that definitive? Couldn't we just leave it? I think that Dave is going to find himself frustrated by which reality he's supposed to be in and go do something else.
Well, I say Dave will not hate this, because while we did bail on Mr. Robot, Dave watched Homecoming for this podcast, and as I recall, he thought it was good. He was compelled by it. Hmm. My theory is that Esmail is better adapting other people's IP than he is at creating his own, based on the evidence of the aforementioned two shows. That said, Dave was not wild about the way Battlestar Galactica ended, as I recall, and doesn't, as far as I know, consider it sacrosanct material. And the fact that it's not going to be a sci-fi original means Dave will be less likely to be prejudiced against it after having been burned so many times in the past by sci-fi originals. Hmm. Dave.
First of all, Sarah, I like the picture you paint of me as a toddler who is easily bored and goes on to new things. You're not wrong. I'm just saying the way you painted it was delightful.
I apologize no problem. For that.
Up top, Tara, you said this wasn't an extension of the Ron Moore thing, but I'm reading that it is, or at least like the way he words that tweet that I think you paraphrased from seems to suggest.
That's a direct quote of the tweet.
Okay, so it takes place in the Ron Moore reboot. It's just not probably about Battlestar Galactica, the ship. It's something else in the same created universe, right?
I guess, sure.
That is good. I think that world was well painted. And I take the point that Esmail does better so far with other people's properties than he does with his own. Certainly, Mr. Robot did go up its own ass, and I did watch the first season and a half and then had to bail. What kept me around in Homecoming is I really thought until the end that Julia Roberts was the Cylon, but turns out she wasn't. I am cautiously optimistic about this new Battlestar, whatever we're going to call it. I feel like Ron Moore created a compelling universe. If somebody else can play in it, I think that's fine. Obviously, his track record is mixed, but I think he seems like a pretty smart guy overall. I think he just needs to do work like this on a more collaborative environment. I think if he is running this, you know, steering this ship solo, it's not going to be as good as if he has like a strong team that creates the series under his leadership, which I realize all TV shows are like that. But you know what I mean? A more collaborative environment versus people, you know, doing acting on his vision once it's written kind of thing. So I don't have strong feelings, but if I had to, and I do because I don't like wishy-washy things, I'm going to say I land on the Dave will not hate the Battlestar Galactica reboot.
Hey,
I hope you're right.
Yeah. I'm never right. Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Mary. She is calling it Starring the Muppets, and she writes, replace a current or past TV cast with Muppets. Specify at least 5 roles and which Muppet should play them. However, we're all pretty sure we've already done this or something very similar as a mini topic. So Dave came up with a way to do it inside out. Instead, we're going to take 5 Muppets from The Muppet Show and replace them with human TV characters or actors. So I'll go first because I read Dave's tweak on this. It's literal. And I went with characters instead of actors, but I suppose it works either way. I'm going to have Statler and Waldorf, and they're going to be played by Ewan and Logan Roy from Succession. That would be James Cromwell nice. And Brian Cox.
Love it.
You can picture them.
But wait, when they're doing their shtick, you have to have that drive you insane piano theme from Succession playing constantly in the background.
Of course. As Scooter, I've cast Cyril Figgis from Archer. Yes, he's a cartoon, but he is also a human, so I feel like he counts. For Miss Piggy, I've cast Sandra, the Jack Hay character from 227, obviously. And for Kermit the Frog, I've cast Andy Travis from WKRP in Cincinnati, just trying to keep everything together. Amazing. And failing a lot of the time.
Yeah, Joe. I can see that.
So I went with all, I also did characters and not actors, and I did them all from the same other show. I know that was a little bit of the, whatever, above and beyond.
Show off.
Or lazy, because I didn't want to think of any other shows, but you guys figure it out. Okay. If it, you know, 601. I also recast Statler and Waldorf as the Beatdown Biddies from Glow.
Love it.
Feel like they could snipe with the best of them. Yep. As Scooter, I cast Bash because always trying to put on a show, and obviously Scooter's the gay one, so like that makes sense. As Janice from the Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem band, Janice is the coolest Muppet. We all know that. So I had her, recast as Cherry from Glow because Cherry is the coolest of everybody on Glow. And as Kermit and Piggy, much as I have had my problems with these two and I don't want them to derail the whole show, Sam and Ruth are the Kermit and Piggy of Glow. So Sam and Ruth can be our tempestuous backstage romance, and we can all, you know, live or die with how that romance does, and it'll be fine. I'm sure it'll be fine.
And Mark Maron can play Sam the Eagle as well.
Oh yeah, true. Good point.
Well, yeah, I'm a little bit bitter, like I'm a tart that I have to go after that, but I went with actors. Kermit will be Patton Oswalt. Fozzie will be Seth Rogen. He's
gonna have to put I also had that on. Choice. Amazing. Okay.
I figured I wouldn't be the only one with that one. Miss Piggy is Jen Lyon from Claws.
Oh,
nice.
That's
Gonzo
good.
Is Rob Benedict from Felicity and various other Abrams projects. And bonus, Camilla is the chicken from BH90210. And is Sam the Eagle, comparison we made many times in television without pity recaps, Mr. James Vanderbeek.
Nice.
Yeah,
excellent. That's good.
Let's go to Chris next. Yeah.
Okay. So for my Kermit the Frog, I went with Kumail Nanjiani. Most lovable man ever on television. Yeah. My Ms. Piggy, I am very proud of this one. I went with Tiffany Pollard. Under no circumstances could anybody else fit the shoes of Ms. Piggy.
And then New York from Flavor of Love?
Yes, Tiffany New York Pollard. my Statler and Waldorf were actually characters. I went with the female and male hormone monsters from Big Mouth. Instead of ripping people to shreds, they talk about how much they want to fuck them. And then I also recast Janice, mostly because I am still catching up with Bake Off, and I am obsessed with Kim Joy, and I want Kim Joy to be my Janice.
I love Kim Joy.
It's
my favorite thing that ever happened.
Wow, these are really good. I have two sets, and I'll read my second set first. In my second set, I put pictures of the Muppets through What Celebrity Do You Look Like? So here's the results for some of those. A lot of them, especially a lot of the simpler main characters like Kermit, it couldn't find a match because the puppet is too simple. So it's a mix. So for Gonzo, it suggested both Tim Curry and Mick Jagger, which I kind of enjoy.
Wow.
Okay.
For Miss Piggy, it wanted to cast Lady Gaga and Adele.
Uh-huh.
Into okay. it.
Do you remember who Sweetums is on the Muppets?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He's the giant monster, 6 feet tall mop of a monster. Yeah. For some reason, after putting it through the system, it suggested all three of these, Lauren Bacall, Joan Allen, and Lucille Ball, and you laugh at that last one, but if you saw the two pictures side by side,
no,
you'd be
I
like,
can see it.
Yeah, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And yet, not Deborah Messing.
Oh, that would be a good one. For Animal, three really good suggestions, and all quite different from each other. Russell Brand, Jake Gyllenhaal, and my favorite, Donald Sutherland.
Yes. Oh my god.
So for Fozzie, which both me and Sarah cast as Seth Rogen, it wants to put Michael Gambon from Harry Potter, etc. in there.
Okay. Yeah. I know.
And lastly, Logan. For the Swedish chef, we have these three suggestions. Chris Kristofferson, Jared Harris.
Yes. Oh,
and Danny Trejo.
What?
I'd love to see Danny Trejo as a Swede.
I mean, I want to see Jared Harris as the first suicidal Swedish chef.
Yep, same. Little Mets pennant in the kitchen.
Absolutely do not cast Harris as Swedish chef for the sake of the kids. All right, so here are my choices. Going with actors, as mentioned, Seth Rogen again for Fozzie. I also did Sweetums, and I put Dave Bautista in as Sweetums. Uh-huh. He played Drax in Guardians of the Galaxy. For Swedish chef, does not look like him, but obviously you have to put Gordon Ramsay in there.
Yeah.
being very frustrated that the only thing he can do is Swedish gibberish. For Beaker, I went with Matt Frewer. Yeah, I was trying to find a guy with a mouth like that. Yeah, he was kind of
that's it. Very good.
And finally, my choice for the newsman who is does it on the Muppet Show, and you remember from Sesame Street, that same guy, Stephen Colbert for him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, excellent.
And that's it. Love so it. Those are our Muppets. Good job, everybody. It is time for the extra hot great canon. A little bit different this week. We have a tag team submission from our guests, Joe and Chris. Take it away, guys.
Thank you. So when Chris and I tried to put our heads together to come up with a show to jointly present for the canon, we kind of huddled around our shared reality TV faves. We saw that you had done, semi-recently at least, done canon entries on RuPaul's Drag Race and Great British Bake Off. So we settled on a show that, to my surprise at the very least, has never been attempted for the canon, which is Project Runway. Part of the reason for this is likely that the golden years of that show, i.e. the Bravo years, are not currently available to stream on a legit site like Hulu, but the internet, being the vast playground that it is, we found the episode we were looking for on Dailymotion. Thank you, Dailymotion. season 2, episode 9, called Flower Power. Now, good people can disagree, but my personal opinion is that season 2 of Project Runway is its best, delivering the show in its most energetic early years, with Michael Kors at his quippiest, Nina Garcia at her most imperious, Tim Gunn building his brand on empathy, and Heidi Klum still working through how to pronounce out. That was much more delightful when it was a struggle for her. Just the opening theme to season 2 is so incredibly evocative for me of the personalities gathered together to compete for $100,000 plus a mentorship at Banana Republic and a 2007 Saturn Sky Roadster, if you remember at the time. Quite the prize indeed. Dave, play clip
one. I made a note of that.
This is Project Runway.
Let's get it on.
The search for the next big fashion designer.
This is a dream come true.
I'm going to do whatever it takes to win.
16 designers.
Everyone here is crazy.
Drama has to happen.
Yes, I'm a competitive person.
Three finalists will make it to Olympus Fashion Week.
You will see me at Fashion Week.
But only one can be the winner.
Heck yeah, I'm going to win this.
For these 16 designers, Project Runway is a chance of a lifetime.
The sound of Kara Jenks saying, everyone here is crazy.
Can I say, when we rewatched this episode, I fully had that intro memorized.
Oh, absolutely. It comes back to you so quickly. It's
almost
just,
15 years later.
Yeah, it's crazy. Drama has to happen. Like, it's just all of it.
Everyone is crazy.
Every one of it. Yes, I love it. you get your mercurial Santino and theatrically distressed Andre and hockey-nosed TV boyfriend Daniel Vasovic. This was a cast for the ages. And I will say that they're upfront that there is too much good stuff in season 2 to pick any one episode with ease. We sort of had a lot of trouble trying to pick, like, what's the perfect season 2 episode.
I feel like this was the one because I was the one who more so pushed for this episode because of the challenge itself. Yeah. This is very memorable challenge.
Yeah, I think, as I said, if there was one single episode that included the motherfucking walk-off and Zulima yelling at Kara to cry and cut and Santino snapping to Nina Garcia that underwear is meant to come off and Wickety Whack Trim and Dirty Diana and Daniel's orchid dress and Andre's chiffon, like, we would have happily chosen that one episode. Unfortunately, that was spread across the entire season because it's a great season.
Let's also not forget Daniel Franco and his self.
Yeah, all of Daniel Franco, truly. Also the ice skating challenge where guest judge Anne Sloey said that the one costume was vulgar because it showed entirely too much tootie, which I'm still laughing about somehow. Pick just one episode that we felt like we had to go with the maybe the most memorable, the most enduring thing about season two. We had to go with the epic tale of Tim Gunn and Andre at Red Lobster.
Yeah, so to start the episode off, the episode picks up after Zulima's elimination, so it's post Cry and Cut, and we're reminded that the aforementioned motherfucking walk-off and Zulima's subsequent snatching of Nick's model, Tara, pretty much broke Nick for the rest of the season. He'd been operating under a dark, petulant, pouty cloud ever since, and it only gets worse when Tara is eliminated from the model competition because of Zulima's loss. And then the challenge this week is an unconventional materials one, and it's one of the best. The designers are sent to a flower shop with $100 to buy as many plants and flowers as they can, and then make an outfit out of them. What ends up happening is that almost all of the designers go heavy on big leafy green plants to provide the structure of their dresses rather than the more delicate flowers one imagines would be tough to work with and cost prohibitive. But then Nina and the other judges will eventually drag them for that, but as we watch them work, it's impressive to see Daniel basket weave a bodice out of leaves and Chloe attempt a very ambitious layered leaves look on top of her dress. But the greatness of the episode doesn't just come from the dresses. It comes from the workroom interactions, as any great Project Runway episode does. This one, however, is a very 2006 discussion about how Daniel has just recently come out of the closet, and it's both illuminating for Daniel as a character, but also as a marker of how much further in the discourse for LGBTQ plus people we have come. Play the clip.
I just came out to my parents a year ago.
You just came out, like, just a year ago, to your parents.
Yeah.
That makes sense back in my day, but, you know, but, like, that was, like, the rent-a-date with the Catholic high school, because I could dance, I could dress well. 20 years later, they're like, why didn't we figure it out?
I grew up in Michigan. It's Bible, like, it's still the Bible Belt. Right. I grew up in a really strict Christian family.
Wow, Daniel, I didn't know.
It was hard, of course. Yeah. I mean,
to be labeled a fag in upper middle class white America was difficult, but everyone has been very supportive. I have made some really good friends, and that helped me grow into the person that I am today.
There's certain things you're gonna get in a guy and certain things you're in a girl, and my ex-girlfriend doesn't know.
What?
Really?
Oh, so you had girlfriend?
Oh yeah.
That's my fear, is to date a
gay. Yeah, your ex was special.
Your biggest fear is to date a gay guy?
For real?
I kind of like how Daniel sort of like gives Chloe a little bit of shit for just like, really, that's your biggest fear, like,
seriously?
Of all the things to have fears about. It's also sort of instructive that, like, back then, like, coming out in sort of privileged white community would be seen as more difficult, whereas now I feel like that has come around to, like, you know, you have, at the very least, you have your privilege there, and that, you know, there's a little bit of a difference in the way that we see that kind of stuff, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Then it's time though for the main event, which is the Santino Tim Gunn Red Lobster stuff. All season, in addition to being this year's stealth villain, Santino has also been the workroom cut up doing impersonations of Michael Kors and especially Tim Gunn. And honestly, the way Tim says Andre with a mixture of like affection, also affectation, and exasperation, there's a little bit of exasperation in his voice when he says Andre. It's very funny and incredibly ripe for parody. So Dave, could you play clip 8?
Andre, look.
I know, it's really messy.
Look at this flotsam and jetsam.
It looks like I did yard work.
Okay, also the way he says flotsam and jetsam, I just, it's so cute. This week, at some prodding by Daniel and the others, Santino weaves a tale of Tim and Andre on a date at Red Lobster that is both funny and surprisingly warm. Santino could be a... sorry. Santino could be a very difficult character to like on the show with his big ego and overbearing personality, but his glee at playing the storyteller of the tale of Tim and Andre at Red Lobster is honestly joyful. Play clip 3.
Will you please do Tim again, but create more?
Andre. I always have to start my sentences with Andre. It gets me into the character. I say, Andre, you really embarrassed me tonight at Red Lobster. There's already a big age difference, Andre, and you acting like a big baby and throwing a plate of lobster in my lap at dinner is not appropriate.
I just kind of created this little story in my head that, you know, Tim and Andre had this romance going.
Andre, but I still think we can make it work.
Why are Tim Gunn and I together in your sick, twisted world?
Andre is laughing along with it. I'm a little bit like, oh my God, does Tim Gunn know about this joke between him and Andre?
If we continue to fight in front of my colleagues at Red Lobster, we're going to have to break up.
They've gone through the honeymoon period, and now they get into these little squabbles at Red Lobster.
We're going to try to make this work.
A short time later, the whole Red Lobster extravaganza gets kicked to the next level when Tim Gunn returns to the workroom and he's been tipped off by some genius producer, or perhaps Chloe, who was sounding a little bit like a narc in that clip, comes into the workroom and smirks at Santino that he hears that he's been doing a devastating send-up of him. Play clip 4.
Santino. What happened to Andre? What happened to Andre? I want to hear more. I understand you're doing a devastating impersonation. And I want to hear it.
Oh, my God.
Tim.
Oh,
you're going to
no.
make me like.
Oh, my God. He's confronting him.
Today, you know, we've been talking. And I just been like. Talking in your voice.
What have I been saying?
You and Andre go to Red Lobster.
Andre and I go to Red Lobster?
Yeah. And then you guys get into an argument, and then you're like, Andre, stop doing this. Every time we have a little tiff, you go and run in the bathroom. What happened to Andre?
It's all you know. What happened to your own mind?
I'm sorry, Tim. You know it's with love.
I do know. And I love you back.
Thanks. Thanks, Tim.
All right. All right. I'm verklempt.
I think it's probably the one time when anyone has ever made Santino blush and really kind of put him in his place in a really funny way.
I just want to say, low-key, the best moment of that is Nick and Andre, like, climbing over each other out of, like, yeah. awkwardness and also yeah. glee, just watching it all go down.
Well, yeah. And I think aside from the absolute joy of watching someone who can be rather villainous like Santino squirm in such a primal way in this moment,
yeah.
what makes the whole Red Lobster thing really special is that it kind of activated exactly why we as a viewership and fans of the show loved Tim Gunn so much and what we loved about him, like, because there is this cuddly thing to him, but he's also such a character. We hadn't really seen anybody like him who was so prim and proper and well-spoken and openly gay on television. And I think, like, I think the legacy of Tim Gunn has a lot to thank Santino for. However, on the runway, the judges are not really into the designer's very floral, light shrubbery gowns that they essentially present. Chloe gets praise for her fun cocktail dress of the painstakingly applied leaves that she barely had time and needed help to finish. Daniel continues to ride his late season hot streak to yet another win after also using the most flowers of all of the designers. Santino, however, gets critiqued by the judges Badgley and Mishka for his leaves looking very plasticky, doing to him spraying shellac on them so that they'd keep their color. After Nina and Michael voice the similar concerns, Heidi, however, stands up for tacky plastic ficuses everywhere. Play clip 9.
Did you do something to the leaves to make it more plastic?
Yes, I sprayed them to preserve the color.
The shine of it makes it look very plastic.
Right. No, I get you.
And it robs it from its natural feeling.
Right.
I have no problem with it being shiny.
Because you're German.
It's nice when they're... maybe your plants at home need some dusting off, but I like it when they're shiny.
Never discount Heidi's ability to love the tacky shit. Andre, however, had a cutely conceived very breakfast at Mossy Tiffany's dress, and it gets criticized, fairly we would say, for not fitting his model very well, kind of looking like a body, like metallic knight armor, and then looking also like a lifeless welcome mat. Meanwhile, Nick's downward slide and martyrdom continues as his messy and Paris Hilton-y dress gets some of the toughest critiques. Play clip 5.
Why don't you think you used more color? There's so much green everywhere.
That's how it turned out to be when I went to the floral shop. I was just picking out greens without realizing. I was actually picking out plants that would be bendable. And it just evolved. I let the plants and what I had sort of transform themselves as I worked with them.
I am a little bit surprised that you guys didn't use more flowers. I mean, it's color, it's beautiful, color. It's so inspirational. You didn't really go for that.
Right. I know I've been doing a lot of, like, Paris Hilton goes on a resort. I just wanted to stray away from what you might expect of me.
What a bullshit artist.
In the end, it is Andre who gets eliminated, leaving him to get a final send-off from his imagined lover, Tim Gunn, though not before Tim Gunn says Andre enough times that it will remain ringing in our ears always. Play clip 6.
Here I am at the end of the line, I guess. When I was in the competition, I felt like I was this angel and I kind of floated above the street. And now I just feel like I'm walking on the ground like everybody else. And that's kind of tough.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Andre, an extremely strong showing, but somebody had to be out. You need to go up to the workroom now and clean up your space.
In the end, we think we picked a representative episode from the best season of this show, and one that included one of the funniest and most memorable moments in series history. We leave it to you to determine if that's good enough for the canon. We just ask one thing of you. Please play clip 7.
Designers, look out for Andre. He's our little lamb, okay?
You're right. Season 2 is a great season. And I will say the same thing about this as I did about The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills last week, which is it's always fun to revisit the early seasons of a long-running reality show before everyone learned, like, how to present themselves in a particular way. They all feel so, like, they just seem like babies. Like, they just have no idea. And I love that you use so much of the Santino doing a bit, not just because it's funny and because all of them are bonded together. And, like, the sweetness of Daniel asking him, like, do more, but make it, like, extend the story.
Create more with it.
Yes. So cute. And when Tim confronts him about it, it is uncomfortable when everyone realizes what's happening. But I also, like, I credit Santino for doing it, you know, like he doesn't try to put it off. He is a good sport about it. He doesn't lie. Like he, you know, this is a funny, cute bit that's not hurtful.
Right.
I agree with Chris that it's a nice moment that develops him as a character too. And like reminds us why he was fun to watch in part, you know. When he wasn't being a dick, which was often. The unconventionals material challenge is always hard because you, as Sarah and I have written about many times, like you never know if you're supposed to like disguise what you're using as a material or, you know, make it obvious what it's made of. Like, is it supposed to look like a textile or is not making it look like a textile the point? And it's like, it's whatever the judges feel like doing on the day. Mm-hmm. So that part of it is kind of annoying when you watch these episodes. But what I remember when I saw the title of this one was like, I thought they all were really good. Like Andre's dress, yes, it does look like a Kevlar vest, as I said when we were watching it. But even that one is well constructed and like it's an interesting idea. And the fact that he got all of that moss to even stick on it, like, is impressive. I mean, I feel like not enough attention was given to the fact that the model herself said it's really uncomfortable, and I believe that. But, you know, it showed well on the runway, I thought.
If I'm remembering correctly, if I can jump in, I remember like an EW interview or something like that with Tim Gunn where he was vociferously like against this elimination, that he loved that dress.
Yeah, agree.
But I mean, I probably would have cut Nick And it's it's also funny to watch this as a 2006 time capsule of like when Paris Hilton was a fashion reference that wouldn't get you laughed off stage.
Right. Right.
How little we knew, you guys. We've really come so far. But the other thing that I wish got more attention was when they're talking about like, why didn't you use more flowers? Why did you spray this shellac on the leaves? It's like there's a glancing reference to, oh, they all remember what happened to Austin Scarlett with the corn husks in season mm-hmm. one. It's like, yeah, exactly. Like you've set them up to fail and they didn't. So what are you mad about? You know? So that part of it is a little...
Giving $100 to them to buy a bunch of flowers is impossible.
Exactly. Yeah. No one talks about the cost being prohibitive as well as like the needing it to do things structurally. Like there's a reason that you pick big leaves. It's so that you can build something with them, which you can't do with flower petals. I mean, Chloe did, but you know, she almost didn't. She barely finished. So this is a great episode. It has everything you want a Project Runway episode to have, from, you know, interesting looks, interesting construction, you know, time pressure and workroom goofiness. That's like one of the more memorable, you know, just random bits of flotsam and jetsam that the show serves up. So I was very happy to watch it again. Excellent presentation. Sarah.
I don't have too much else to add. I knew that I would be voting for this before I rewatched a frame of it. I can't think of a better episode, and I also can't think of a more episode. I think if you asked anyone, like, name the top three moments of Project Runway history, it's like, you know, this, like the what happened to Andre, and I don't know, Wendy Pepper's mailman outfit. Like, there's just not like there's not
Wendy
a lot
Pepper
of,
talking to herself.
Yeah, there's not a lot of it. May she rest. There's not a lot of other contenders for like the Project Runwayest.
Right.
Moment, or like Morganza, maybe. And please feel free to present season one episodes. I'm here for it. But you have so many like models. This is also a competition for you as well. Like either also or as well, Jeff Probst. Come on.
Right.
Project Runway is the chance of a lifetime.
Yeah. The chance of a lifetime. And the prizes, like they're not, you know, they're not fugazi, but compared to what they give away now.
I know.
On the show where they're like, you know, four floors of Trump Tower, like, okay, shit. All right. So you have like Michael Kors teasing Heidi for liking shiny things. You have a reference to the motherfucking walk off, which like it made it into this episode, even though it wasn't, was amazing. You have Nick's nervous breakdown, which sort of presages, his whole scene on that, whatever Tim Gunn competition show that was such a disaster that I recapped every episode of. Thank you. And you have Tim Gunn. I mean, I was down on Tim Gunn at the end of his tenure because I felt like he was sort of stuck in his ways and kind of being kind of a favoring and really not favoring certain designers. Like I'm still kind of turned off by how he treated Swapnil. But he used to be really good at this. And of course he didn't mind this Andre Santino thing because he was a teacher. Like he's used to them acting fools in this way and being exhausted from working on projects and, you know, having jokes about the like that's a thing that happens. And oh my God, he was so hot. I had completely forgotten how foxy he was. Anyway.
Yeah,
I'll be in my bunk. Just kidding. Really, the use of vulgar by Michael Kors, like this just has so many.
I almost clipped that
Project
Classic.
Runway vulgar. Ugh, I mean, sometimes I miss him. Just very Project Runway-y. Excellent choice. Excellent presentation. This was a delight to revisit, and I almost kept going on Daily Motion through the rest of the season.
I know,
had
right?
To resist. Definitely
speaking of Michael Kors too, there's a moment where he goes, I mean, let's be honest, and I like I inhaled very sharply because I'm like, oh, it's going to be another great like Michael Kors metaphor. And it wasn't quite. That was when he was just like, it looks like a welcome mat. And I was like, yeah, it does. But I was really primed for like a real humdinger of a Michael Kors comparison.
I thought I was a little bit disappointed. This is why it's like a 98 for me and not a full 100. I thought this was the one where Andre like just Gumby'd off the stage and flailed like past the...
He does
like
a little bit.
He does kind of at the very, very end. But it's almost silent the way he does that. But yeah.
Where's Andre? Anyway, Dave, take us home.
I may have missed something. I kind of feel like Killface. I think I missed a key reference. But what was that little quip about she loves shiny things because she's German?
I think he was just calling her tacky.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does German have to do with
it? And calling all Germans tacky.
Yeah. I see. Okay. So it's just that. All right.
Can confirm.
I'll accept your answer. I really liked the whole Red Lobster stuff. It was funny, but also humanizing for everybody involved. Like,
yeah.
Rare that, you know, I know he's not a judge per se, but, you know, he's a judgy figure in the show. So it's nice. And it shows that he was a good sport about it. Watching this episode now, Project Runway isn't as guilty of this as other reality shows, but it's interesting always to go back to an earlier episode and see the show before feature inflation.
Yeah.
You look at a show like Amazing Race, and it started off with detours and roadblocks. And by the second season, there's like
U-turns.
It's Calvin Ball, and the score is cute of 12, you know, and it's just like, what's going on? There's too much going on. You've packed in too much. And I guess like a Project Runway eventually had like the accessory wall and this and that and stuff like that.
Oh, God.
But it's interesting to see a plainer, more straightforward, closer to the metal version of the show that you are still watching. I told Tara during the show when they started at the florist to pick materials for their dresses, I really hate when they do these, what do they call them? Unconventional materials challenge. And I was like it's supposed to be a show about who's going to do couture fashion the best. Why are they working with plants and like recycled tire bits and shit like this? And it always annoys me because it's like, well, it's not what they're actually going to do. Tara made the argument that, do you want to paraphrase it quickly, Tara?
Well, I just said that they're, you know, the purpose of doing these is like to highlight the art of fashion, that it's not only functional. And sometimes you design clothes that are only meant to be seen on the runway as pieces of art, as opposed to like saleable garments.
Right.
Yeah.
I accept that answer. I also accept that this is a TV show and maybe it's more interesting to see people fail to make a dress out of a plant. I get that. But there's something about it that screams to me, this should be like the minor challenge of an episode, not the major challenge of an episode. Mm. But that's just my hang up. Certainly to watch the guy. And I do agree, it did look like a doormat. It did look super stiff and removed the shape of the model to the point where she kind of looked like a girl. That was a mistake. Also, Spanish moss always looks cheap. You can never make Spanish moss, whether it is on a doormat dress or glued onto one of those useless styrofoam orbs that you put in a bowl because you're basic. Like one of those, it just never doesn't look like.
It looks like AstroTurf. Yeah.
You hear that, Michaels and Hobby Lobby? Cut it out.
As I quietly push my styrofoam orb bowl out of the frame.
There's a lot of reasons for it, but one of the major reasons why it does is, you know what you can't dust or clean? Something covered in Spanish moss. Yeah. So it looks new for like a week and then it's forever dirty.
Then the pet hairs come. Yeah.
Yep.
Again, point to Heidi and her plastic ficus, which you can, as she mentioned, just dust off and it looks fine.
I had no problem with the shiny leaf on the dress. It's like sensible to me. You're only going to wear it once. But still, I appreciated that you want it to look like it was picked from the jungle floor and made into a dress today, not chosen from a florist 2 days ago and now it's dry and desiccated. Like,
I did kind of laugh at Nina's objection seeming to be that like Santino halted the process of photosynthesis or something like that. Just like, it's okay that it's been, you know, done to. It's fine.
Yeah. Like in the outtake, she stood up and screamed at him like, how dare you play God? Like, so I'm not a Project Runway watcher. Obviously I've seen my share just because Tara watches a lot. And also it's come up on the, you know, we've covered it on the show quite a bit. But you can tell that this episode has a certain buoyancy that I feel like a lot of episodes don't. This is sort of special. And I think the Red Lobster Andre impression anchors a lot, which is fun about this episode. And I've come around on the plant dress thing as a way to entertain us, not a way to find America's next top fashion designer. That's my, I will cling to that one. But a great episode. So with that, let us put it to the official vote, starting with Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes.
Tara Ariano.
Me too, yay.
And I will say yay too, so that's 3-3. Woo! And that means Project Runway Season 2, Episode 9, Flower Power. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for Winner and Loser of the Week, and it sounds like we have two sides of the same coin, if I'm reading my notes correctly. Tara, who's the winner?
Correct. We have a roundup of Emmy winners, not necessarily winners in their categories, although there are some of those. First, hometown hero for Chris Vile, Nina West, first person to walk an Emmy red carpet in full drag. This is a, she was a RuPaul's Drag Race contestant in the last season. Billy Porter, the first out gay actor of color to win lead actor in a drama series for Pose. Jarrell Jerome, the first Afro-Latino and youngest winner ever for best supporting actor in a limited series for When They See Us. And Michelle Williams, one for Fosse Verdon, awesome, used her speech to talk about pay equity, particularly for women of color, great. Brought Busy Phillips as her date, who wouldn't? Yeah. Looked amazing. Her dress is like one of my favorites she's ever worn, and she's worn a bunch. However, racist and sexist pigs who were mad about the speech ended up on Twitter yelling at the other Michelle Williams from Destiny's Child. She had to put out a response video explaining she was not who they were mad at. Instantly iconic with her saying, as you can see, I am black. Amazing. So great Emmy moments all around.
All right. And who are Emmy losers?
The big four networks. They collected an all-time low of 16 Emmy wins altogether. During the In Memoriam segment, a photo was used for Andre Previn that was not Andre Previn.
Oh no, is that true?
Yes.
This isn't really there are no losers here, but no. Julia Louis-Dreyfus lost Comedy Actress for her last season of Veep to Phoebe Waller-Bridge for her last season of Fleabag. Sometimes the universe, the Emmyverse bends towards justice. The ratings were terrible. The hostless format got roasted. Just another year in the Emmy commentariat.
Speaking of getting roasted and just another episode, do you know what time it is? That was terrible.
Roast time. Roast terrible. Time.
Nice.
Speaking about winning something but feeling like it's ultimately worthless, do you know what time it is? It's game time.
There it is.
Nice. All right, everybody.
This is the ninth game time of the season. Our season scores currently are Tara 4, Sarah 3, value guess 1. So if Tara wins tonight, she wins the season. Today we are playing Uncle Billy and Aunt Joan from both Chris Billig and Dan Cassino. Tag teaming this one. They earn themselves an extra credit topic of their choosing. In the era of peak TV, we pay a lot of attention to prestige shows, but what about those good, hardworking, hour-long primetime network shows of the heartland? In this game, you'll be asked multiple choice questions about shows you may have stopped watching or only have heard of from your Uncle Billy or Aunt Joan at Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Aha! Hotel TV.
To make it easier, all of the shows are currently airing or ended their runs in the past few years.
Okay.
We have 32 questions and a tiebreaker available. Tara, steel meal situation, please.
Thank you, Dave. I have 5 steel meals. The valued guests have 1.
Okay. Can you explain that for our new guest, Chris, how the steel meals
Yes. Work? Chris, if someone gets an answer wrong and you know it, you can jump in before Dave gives the right answer and say steel meal, and then you can say the correct answer and get
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, we do have 2 valued guests playing, and we're not playing a team game, so I'm going to let you both use 1 steel meal today.
Oh,
so
okay.
Each got 1 to use during today. And if you don't use it, we'll set it back to 1 next week. All right, let's throw it to Pinky to see who is going to go first.
We will start with Tara.
All right, so our order today is Tara, Joe, Sarah, Chris, are we ready to play Uncle Billy and Aunt Joan?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
All right, here we go. We're going to start with our ABC chunk. Tara?
Yep.
Grey's Anatomy has found creative ways to get rid of long-term characters. Which of these did not happen? A, Izzy got cancer, hallucinated having sex with a ghost, then disappeared. Mm-hmm. B, Christina told everyone that too much crazy shit goes on in this hospital and moved to Switzerland. Mm-hmm. C, Preston was wounded in a plane crash, then eaten by a bear. Mm-hmm. D, George joined the army, they got run over by a bus.
I know there was a plane crash, but I don't think he got eaten by a bear. So I'm going to say C did not happen.
You are correct. That was the one that did not happen. Everybody else died or disappeared the way I just read it.
Joe is furious that Grey's Anatomy is included in this
Utterly
game.
Furious.
Okay, Inside Baseball, they wanted the title of this show, Flyover TV, but I was like, if you call it Flyover TV, you're either going to get people from the middle states saying no, or are you going to get people like Joe say no, Grey's Anatomy can't be Flyover TV. And it didn't help. I tried to call it Uncle Billy and Aunt Joan, but still, we're getting shit for it, so you can't win. Lesson learned.
I'm just mad that I knew it. Stone cold.
But Joe, yes. At least you're getting a Grey's Anatomy question. Everyone on Grey's Anatomy has slept with everyone else. Which of the following did not happen? Owen has been divorced twice, both times because he found after marriage that his wife didn't want children. B, Meredith was romantically entangled with her dead mother's lover, who is also the father of her half-sister. C, Jackson is in a long-term relationship with his stepfather's long-lost half-daughter. D, Callie Torres divorced her wife and pursued a romance with a doctor who killed longtime lead Derek.
Give me C one more time.
Jackson Avery is in a long-term relationship with his stepfather's long-lost half-daughter.
Yeah, that is happening. Yeah, B is the one that's not.
You are correct. Was never romantically entangled with her dead mother's lover.
No, because that would have been the chief of surgery, and that would have been bad. Anyway.
Sarah D. Bunting, your first question coming up. Continuing our Grey's Anatomy question.
Oh, God.
The surgeons on Grey's Anatomy have had to deal with a shocking amount of wildlife over the years, including all but which one of these? A, someone's pet lion mauling a bunch of patients. B, Izzy operating on a deer. C, removing a fish from the inside of a man's penis. D, performing emergency surgery on a beached whale to remove trash from its stomach.
I feel like any of these could have happened. So I'm going to go with B.
B, Izzy operating on a deer did happen.
That definitely happened.
The one that did not happen was beached whale emergency surgery.
Oh, that was my second choice. Shit. Mm.
All right, Chris, your first question coming up. Guess what show is about? You better believe it's Grey's Anatomy.
Uh-oh.
How did Grey's Anatomy explain the appearance of Meredith's second half-sister, who is also a brilliant surgeon and coincidentally started working at the same hospital? Your choices. A, sister was born from eggs her mother had donated as part of a medical study. B, the mother was secretly artificially inseminated in an effort to create a daughter that was a better heir for her surgical skills. C, the mother carried her as a favor for longtime family friends. D, Meredith had just plain forgotten that her mother had been pregnant and given birth when she was a grade schooler.
D?
Yes, D.
Yep.
Yes, yes.
Wow.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. That was that episode in a nutshell.
This was the emergence of this character was literally around the time that I stopped watching that show.
I wonder why.
I was like, I'm out.
Wow.
All right, Tara, we're leaving Grey's Anatomy behind, but we're still on the ABC train.
Okay.
On ABC's Once Upon a Time, which of the following is not part of the backstory of the Seven Dwarves?
Okay.
Not. A.
Got it.
Dopey was their leader until he suffered a traumatic brain injury in a battle with the bear from Brave.
Dark.
B, there used to be eight of them until Stealthy died during a prison break and was sent to hell. C, Grumpy used to be called Dreamy, but then he had a bad breakup and was renamed by a magic pickaxe.
Uh-huh. Oh my God.
D, they were all hatched out of eggs. Which one of those is not part of the backstory of the Seven
Dwarfs? Fucking hell.
So three of them is. That's insane.
I'm going to say magic pickaxe is the one.
Incorrect.
Fuck you.
The one that was not true was Dopey was not their leader and suffered a traumatic brain injury with the bear from Brave. I did not.
Wow, the show.
Somehow.
I actually knew that one. Kill me now.
Damn.
With a magic pickaxe.
We're also giving you a Once Upon a Time question. Which of the following twists did not happen on Once Upon a Time? A, Hades isn't really a bad guy. He's just acting that way to impress the Wicked Witch of the West. B, Little Red Riding Hood is actually the big bad wolf. C, Prince Charming is actually the twin brother of Prince Charming who died in a duel. Or D, the fox from The Fox and the Hound was actually Robin Hood, who had been transformed by Merlin.
Jesus Christ. Okay. I think it's either B or D. Give me B one more time.
Little Red Riding Hood is actually the big bad wolf, or the fox is actually Robin Hood.
I'm going to say B, Little Red Riding Hood is actually the big bad wolf.
It was
Damn
D,
it.
The fox from The Fox and the Hound was not Frickin' Robin hell. Hood, who was not transformed by Merlin. Mm. All right, back to Sarah. ABC's Reef Break, an actual hour-long drama that is currently airing, centers on A professional surfer named Kat Chambers, who is also a con artist recruited to help the police. B, a professional surfer named Elsie Duvernay, who is also a widow of a drug smuggler. C, a professional surfer named Felicity Phil Phillips, who is also a money launderer who gets in way over her head. Or D, a professional surfer named Tori Peters, who is also a reef ecologist caught in a deadly conspiracy.
Wow.
So you got Kat Chambers, you got Kat, who is a con artist, you got Elsie, widow of a drug smuggler, you got Felicity, money launderer, Tori, ecologist caught in a deadly conspiracy.
A.
A is correct. Kat Chambers.
Yay.
Way to go. All right, back to Chris.
Yeah.
Network TV weirdness is not limited to scripted shows. Which has not been a personalized prize offered on the recent revival of Press Your Luck? A, a 10-year supply of cheese. B, a swimming pool installation including the same water slide Kim Il-jong had on his house. C, following Michael Bolton on tour for a week. Or D, professional portraiture of the pets of the winners.
Pet portraiture?
That was, in fact, a prize. Was not a prize. The swimming pool installation featuring the North Korean water slide was not.
Wow.
We should have gone on that Michael Bolton episode, guys.
Could have won, right?
Guys, we are all tied up right now.
Oh, boy.
All right, back to Tara.
Yep.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has been making use of the Marvel characters that no one else wants for some time now.
Yep.
Which of these comic characters has not been brought into the show? A, Deathlok, a cybernetic zombie soldier who sometimes is from the future.
Sure.
Damon Hellstrom, the literal son of literal Satan.
Mm-hmm.
Lorelei, an Asgardian seductress.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry, that was C. D, the Patriot, a World War II era hero with a shield that's legally distinct from Captain America.
Oh, God. Oof.
A, Deathlok. B, Damon Hellstrom. C, Lorelei. D, the Patriot.
C.
Incorrect.
Fuck.
Lorelei was on the show. Not on the show, Damon Hellstrom, the literal son of literal Satan.
Mm.
Sorry. Okay. Back to Joe. I know Joe watched Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or watches.
Yes.
Is it still on? Are we still doing Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Yeah, it's technically one more season after that. Yes.
Good for them. All right, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was one of the places Marvel tried to make Inhumans a thing people cared about. Which Inhuman has not appeared on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.? Yo-Yo, who has super speed but is yo-yoed back to her original spot. Flint, a geokinetic who can manipulate earth and rocks. Lash, who has energy conversion and manipulation abilities. Or D, I keep on forgetting to say the letters, I apologize. Or D, Inferno, who can turn his body into fire and brimstone. To recap, A, Yo-Yo, B, Flint, C, Lash, D, Inferno.
What's weird is that I feel like at every single one, I was like, yep, that was. And now I've got four of them. And like, wait a second, one of them wasn't. I sort of screwed myself there. It's either B or D.
So we're talking Flint, a geokinetic.
Flint or Inferno.
Inferno.
Gosh, I'm going to say Flint. Damn it.
Inferno. Another BD decision does not go your way. I'm sorry.
I know.
All right, back to Sarah. Here's our last of our ABC questions.
Okay.
On ABC's The Inhumans, which of the following is not true of the lead character, Black Bolt? Black Bolt actor Anson Mount, without being asked by anyone, developed his own language for the character to use. He thinks it could be as big as Klingon. B. Black Bolt is just the short form of his real name, Blackagar Boltagon. C. He never actually talks. D. His power comes from a sentient black hole that lives in his head. Three of those are true, one is not. We got Mount making up a language. We got Blackagar Boltagon, never talks. Power comes from a black hole in his head.
I wish B weren't true, but I feel that it probably is. So I'm going to say C.
C, he never actually talks, is true. The character never talks. He uses some sort of sign language he made up himself. His power comes from a sentient black hole that lives in his head is not a characteristic of Black Bolt.
It's Blackagar Boltagon?
Yep.
What the crispy fuck?
Yeah, somehow that show didn't survive.
Stupid, shitty ass backstory. Why am I getting mad? Who cares?
All right, Chris, we're starting off CBS with you. CSI has a lot of unexpected guest stars over the years. Which of these is not among them? A, about half the cast of Beverly Hills 90210 who are reuniting at a fan convention when Shannon Doherty is murdered. B, both Danny Bonaducci and David Cassidy, although not on the same episode. C, Charlie Sheen in an unofficial crossover with Two and a Half Men in which a Roseanne stand-in gets murdered. Or D, Tippi Hedren and Robert Guillaume as performers from Vegas in the 50s. Which one of those did not happen?
All of those are decently far-fetched, but the 90210 is a lot of people to get into a room together, so I'm going to say A, 90210.
That's thinking like a show budget manager, and you are correct.
Nice. Hey, Chris pulls ahead.
All right, Tatara, here is your first CBS question. Mm-hmm. Bull is going into its fourth season. Some of the original characters are no longer there. But who is still part of the central team of jury consultants? A, Chunk Palmer, an All-American defense lineman at the University of Georgia, who now works as a fashion stylist for their clients. B, Ray Spiewak, an autistic psychologist who decodes micro-expressions. C, Marissa Morgan, a licensed sex therapist who used to work for Homeland Security. Or D, Dr. Jason Bull, who's officially not playing a sexy young Dr. Phil. So Bull is going to its fourth season.
Yep.
Some of the original characters are no longer there. Who's still part of the central team of consultants?
Chunk.
Chunk is incorrect. Fun to say Chunk Palmer, though. Your answer was B, Spiewak. All right, Joe.
Yes.
While Bull works with lawyers, he actually hates lawyers because A, a drunk driving lawyer killed his parents and other lawyers helped to cover it up.
Oh, God.
B, his scheming ex-wife is a lawyer along with her whole family. C, despite having three PhDs and a pilot's license, he failed the bar exam multiple times. Or D, the American legal system reproduces economic inequalities into a theoretical, impartial justice system.
Aw, thanks, Dan.
So one of these is true?
One of these is true. The reason he hates lawyers.
Bull is the one that's based on Dr. Phil, maybe? So yeah. I want to say the PhD one is true? The three PhDs and whatever? Yeah!
Nice! Having three PhDs and a PAS license, he failed the bar exam multiple times. You are correct. Good for a point. CBS question for Sarah D. Bunting. Why is everyone after Cleopatra's body on CBS's Blood and Treasure? A, the body can be used to create a bioweapon. B, scientists want to clone her for conflicting reasons. C, she was buried wearing priceless jewelry. Or D, her body has mystical healing properties. Today,
given
I discovered
that I never heard of this show before.
Exactly.
You just mentioned
Blood
it,
and Treasure is a thing. Yeah.
Any of these is legit. So I'm going to say B.
B, scientists want to clone her for conflicting reasons, is not the reason everyone is after her body. Of course, her body can be used to create a bioweapon. So everybody wants it for that. All right, Chris, how does the good doctor's Sean Murphy save a patient's career? A, by restoring a Cirque du Soleil-esque performer's sense of balance. B, restoring a porn star's sense of sexual pleasure. C, restoring a celebrity chef's sense of taste and smell. Or D, restoring a federal judge's sense of morality.
Oh, God.
With Moralitol.
A Cirque du Soleil? Eh?
Nope. It was restoring a porn star's sense of sexual
Christ.
Wow.
I would also have guessed Cirque.
The good doctor doing the good work. All right. It is time for our score break here at the halfway point. Tara, scores, please.
It's very, very close. Joe and Chris are tied with 2 each. Sarah and I are tied with 1 each.
Okay. Not a high-scoring game, but everybody has some manner of score.
Soccer, another thing we don't watch.
All right, guys, this is question 17.
It's Spread Eagle.
It is for Tara. It is a question we will read navally. On NCIS, our lead hates technology. In the best tradition of show, don't tell, this is communicated to the viewer through all but one of these. A, he shoots a GPS with a machine gun. He bites a USB stick to try to get it to work. C, he destroys so many cell phones that the staff keeps extras in the office. Or D, he stomps a Roomba to death.
Roomba.
Incorrect. He did that. He also destroyed cell phones. He also bites a USB stick, but he does not shoot a GPS with a machine gun.
Damn.
Joe, if you're feeling ripped off that you didn't get a question you can answer navally, rejoice, because here it comes.
Good.
NCIS has been the most popular show in the U.S. and the world many times.
Oy.
So what's the name of the lead character? A, Wayne Ulysses Grant. B, Leroy Jethro Gibbs. C, Michael Nat Turner Garrison. Or D, Leroy Jenkins Glenn.
Thank you, Dad, for watching these reruns on USA when I've been home for holidays. It's the second one, the Jethro one.
You are correct. Leroy Jethro Gibbs, not Richard Leroy Jenkins Glenn, which we all wished it was. This is question. Here is a CBS question for Sarah D. Bunting. Who has not been a long-term reoccurring cast member on NCIS? A, Wilmer Valderrama. B, Eric Roberts. C, Lauren Hawley. Or D, Robert Wagner.
Oh, boy.
Valderrama.
Valderrama is incorrect. He has been on 73 episodes.
Wow!
Robert Wagner has been at 13. Lauren Hawley on 70. Your correct answer, Eric Roberts.
Wow. Damn,
really should be on NCIS every
week. Really are the worst, Roberts.
All right, Chris. our last question of our CBS chunk. On CBS's reboot of MacGyver, which one of these unlikely builds has our hero not carried out? Made a thermal lance from a pipe, road flare, and some magnesium he had lying around. B, put someone in a temporary coma using eye drops, heart pills, dental floss, and a pen. C, escape from a bank vault using hand sanitizer, a defective hoverboard, and a whoopee cushion. Or D, defuse a Soviet-era bomb with a rusty hook and the Y2K glitch.
Oh my god.
C?
C is correct. All right. It is time for NBC shows. Tara. As early as season one on NBC's Blind Spot, they were starting to run out of tattoos to interpret. So it turned out that A, her tattoos were made of special ink that shifts and fades over time. B, the tattoos we can see are actually made out of smaller microscopic tattoos. C, some of the tattoos are actually holographic. Or D, the lead is also covered in invisible ultraviolet tattoos.
Oh boy. It's another B or D situation. D.
D is correct.
Hey!
Oh, good one.
Ultraviolet tattoos were the remedy to Blind Spot's conundrum.
Wow.
I actually watched that show and I forgot that.
For Joe, which one of the following is not among the actual hot nonsense stemming out of a plane that lands years after being missing on NBC's Manifest? Not. Boy. A. Some of the passengers now have psychic powers. B. The suggestion that this has happened to others before, including Amelia Earhart and D.B. Cooper. C. Some of the passengers have been kidnapped and tortured by a shadowy agency. Or D. In some great network synergy, one of the main characters has vision of a peacock.
What's right, C again?
Three of those things happened. One didn't. C is some of the passengers have been kidnapped and tortured by a shadowy agency.
I can deliberate if you want to do a rendition of Coop Theory as well. While I wait.
Joe needs some thinking time.
I need some thinking music. No, I'm going to say the peacock, but like...
Are you? Or are we going to hear this now?
If you want to get down, I'm going to show you the way. There it is. Let me hear you say.
Coop, there he is. Coop, there he is. Coop, there he is.
Oh, I missed you, buddy.
Takes me back. I'm going to say the peacock. I'm going to say D.
It was, in fact, your old friend, B.
B.
Amelia Earhart and D.B. Cooper, in fact.
Oh, boy.
Did not happen on that show somehow. All right, Sarah. NBC's contribution to inexplicable game shows is Ellen's Game of Games, in which regular people compete in all but one of the following events. A. Blindfolded musical chairs. B. One-eyed monster, in which contestants play card sharks and there's some nonsense about teeth and a monster head. C. Pin the tail on the wrong key, which is the kids' game, but bad placements lead to wrong notes being played in a song and there's dancing for some reason. Or D, tuba toothpaste, in which contestants get shot in the face with toothpaste. So, musical chairs, one-eyed monster, pin the tail on the wrong key, tuba toothpaste.
I feel like one-eyed monster would not get past S&P, so I'm going to say B.
B, one-eyed monster is incorrect. That is actually on the show. Pin the tail on the wrong key is the fake one.
Good grief.
Sounds like a Hollywood
Game Night. Which sounds like a Hollywood Game Night game.
Yes!
Thank you. Feel validated.
Yeah.
All right, this is for Chris for an NBC show I was unaware of, and it sounds amazing. Let's all pay attention to all these character names. Who was not a resident of NBC's Midnight Texas, Chris?
Who?
Yep. A, Joe and Chewy Strong. A married fallen angel and half-demon. Reverend Emilio Sheenan, a were-tiger who runs the wedding chapel. C, yeah. Dr. Candace Sharp, a couples therapist who can read her patient's mind. Or D, taking the cake, Fiji Kavanaugh, a free-spirited witch who owns a magic shop. Let's just take a moment to appreciate Fiji Kavanaugh.
Wow.
I'm going to say C, the relationship therapist.
Correct.
Wow.
Candace
Shaw.
Nice.
Oh, someone likes shows about were-tigers.
The words that just flew at me. I picked a letter.
Tara Ariano, NBC's time travel show Timeless has featured characters being hit on by a sexy young version of which of the following? A, Abraham Lincoln's son, Robert Todd Lincoln. Mm-hmm. B, civil rights icon Rosa Parks. Mm. C, Nazi rocket scientist Wernher von Braun. Mm. Or D, a six-packed William Howard Taft.
Okay, I think it's which one has or which one hasn't.
Has.
Which one has Wernher von Braun?
Incorrect. Sexy young version of Robert Todd Lincoln.
Damn.
Hitting on everybody on Timeless.
Lincoln Jr.
I don't know. I'm gonna write Hot Taft, though. That sounds like a good show.
Six-pack Taft, we call it. Joe will wrap up our NBC section. Which of the following is not a revelation about Red Reddington? Oh, God. James Spader's character on The Blacklist.
Oh, Christ.
Red Reddington. Okay. A, he's had extensive plastic surgery, which is why he looks nothing like the actor playing a younger version of the character. B, Red Reddington is long dead and James Spader is playing an imposter. C, he's the biological father of the series lead. Or D, he's never seen Star Wars. Three of those are revelations. One is not. Which one is not?
The not is that he's the biological father.
You haven't been keeping up with Blacklist, apparently, because I guess they gave into that. He has not had extensive plastic surgery. All right, fine. The CW is on deck, guys.
Woo!
To Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes.
On Riverdale. Stay out of Riverdale. Betty and Veronica deal with a slut-shaming football star by A, blackmailing an FBI agent into investigating him, B, dressing up in a black hood and attacking those close to him until he comes clean, C, having Sabrina the Teenage Witch curse him in a, well, appropriate way, or D, torturing him until he confesses on tape to lying.
This is what did happen?
Yep.
I mean, once again, I don't want this to have happened, but it's so bonkers that it probably did. So I'm going to say Sabrina.
Steel meal.
Joe's steel mealing.
Yep. Is it D?
It is D. Torturing him until he confesses
choice.
On tape to lying.
I thought it was hoodies.
Simple and effective. Torture works. Mm-hmm. All right, back to Mr. Chris. Which one of these is not a plot line from season 2 of Riverdale? Stay out of Riverdale. A, Archie joins a prison fight club. B, Cheryl Blossom is forced into gay conversion therapy. C, Jughead is afraid he might be a werewolf. Or D, the town is caught up in satanic rituals tied to a game that is legally distinct from Dungeons and Dragons.
I do not watch Riverdale. I'm just going to take a wild leap that it's A.
A, Archie joins a prison fight club was a plotline from season 2, as was gay conversion therapy, as was the Dungeons & Dragons-esque game. The one that we were looking for, Jughead is afraid that it might be a werewolf. Did not happen. Happened in the comics, but not the show, apparently.
Ah.
All right, Tara, here's your CW question.
Okay.
Bulletproof is an actual show that airs on the CW. What's it actually about? A, heroes on Image Comics' Guardians of the Globe team.
Okay.
Detectives in the UK's National Crime Agency, but it's also about class relations, because England. C, members of America's Drug Elimination Force, a covert branch of the US military. Or D, a multinational group about a branch of Europol that's translated as Central Organization of Police Specialists, or COPS. Bulletproof.
I think it's B.
You think correctly. Detectives in the UK, National Crime Agency. All right, moving on to Fox for our last three questions of the game. Joe.
Yes.
Who doesn't have to hope that we've all forgotten about the role in Gotham? Paul Reubens as the Penguin's father. Carol Kane as the Penguin's mother. Ron Rifkin as a cult leader. Stone Cold Steve Austin as swamp zombie Solomon Grundy. Solomon Grundy hates super friends.
So one of these is not true?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Of Gotham.
Of right. Gotham. Yeah. The only one I'm pretty sure is definitely true is Paul Reubens. You'd think I would have heard if it was Stone Cold Steve Austin. And then what is C?
We got Paul Reubens as the Penguin's father, Carol Kane as the Penguin's mother, Ron Rifkin as a cult leader, Stone Cold right. as Solomon Grundy.
Is Ron Rifkin one that somebody would make up? That's really, like, that's real smooth if that is true. I'm gonna say Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Stone Cold Steve Austin. Is this the dime that Joe's D answer is correct?
Yeah,
it is.
Yay!
I really was on that journey with you with Rifkin, though. It's right? like, oh shit, I think you should pick C.
I thought that Tim Paul Reubens was a trick question because I thought he was Penguin's dad in the movie.
He was. That's why there was a story about it, which is why I remember.
Oh, yeah. Sneaky. Pretty sneaky, yeah. Sis.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting. Your Fox question is, the cast of Ryan Murphy's 9-1-1 on Fox has dealt with all of these except a flat earther blown up by his own rocket, B, a man who is somehow shot by a tree, C, a premature baby stuck in a pipe after a scared teenage mother flushed it down the toilet, or D, a shark attack on a California freeway. So let's rewind here. A, flat earther blown up by his own rocket. B, man shot by tree. C, premature baby stuck in pipe. D, shark attack on freeway. Three of these happened, one did not.
Shark attack.
And I guess you've never worked at 911, but yeah, shark attack on the California freeway happened.
Very common, yeah.
Premature baby to pipe, natch. Man who was shot by a tree, of course. The one that did not happen, flat earther blown up by his own rocket.
I believe that earthers. Happened in real life, though. Every time I hear something about the show, I'm like, why am I not watching it? It sounds insane.
The note for the shot by tree is, he put explosives on the tree because he was angry at it because of his wife's suicide, and it goes from there.
Right.
And so on and so forth.
As one does. All right, last question for Chris. Fox ran two seasons of The Gifted, an X-Men show without any of the X-Men you've heard of.
Oh.
Which one of these was not one of the Marvel mutants on the show? So which one does not belong? A, Evangeline, who can turn into a dragon subject to budget constraints. Pedro, a blue guy who can make people scared. C, Stacy, a prostitute who can manipulate pleasure centers. Or D, Thunderbird, a Native American stereotype with superhuman strength and senses. Which one of these was not one of the Marvel mutants on the show?
I'm going to go with the prostitute.
The prostitute. Well, it sounds like it shouldn't belong. And it doesn't. You are correct.
Ah! Nice guess.
And that is the end of regulation game time. Tara Ariana, let's get back to final scores.
Well, it's very exciting. Sarah has one. I have three. One. Joe and Chris are tied with 5 apiece.
Ooh, it's Battle of the Oscars podcast here in our tiebreaker. So this is how it works. I am going to read you a question. It operates on a popular price guessing game show rules where you have to guess the number without going over. We already know Value Guess is going to win, but who's going to take the glory home? Let's find
Good
out.
Luck.
Dick Wolf has found a lot of success in his Chicago-based shows on NBC. Across the 4 shows in the franchise, guess how many episodes of all the shows have been aired as of August 2019?
We're going to Price is Right this.
So give it a little noodle.
Yeah.
We'll go to Mr. Reed first. You've got four franchises. We got your Chicago Fire, your Chicago PD. We've got your Chicago Med, and we've got your Chicago Justice. Across all four of those series, how many episodes have there been?
I'm going to say 410.
410 is Mr. Reed's answer. Chris?
I'm going to say 425.
410 to 425. We're going to have to amend the rules because you both went over.
Both went over.
Back.
But the closest was Mr. Joe Reed with 410. The correct answer, very close. 397.
Wow, that was close.
Well played, guys. Done. Well noodled.
Good job.
Valued guest.
Congratulations, job, Joe, guys. On behalf of valued guests. Well done.
Well played, Chris.
I did my best picking of four letters.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We return to Downton Abbey for the royal visit before going around the dial with stops at new CBS sitcoms, Unbelievable, 30 for 30, and Dark Crystal, The Age of Resistance. We ask, will Dave hate the new but old but not that old Battlestar Galactica, and then turned a bunch of Muppets into humans. In the canon, either you're in or you're out, and Project Runway's Flower Power is in. We crown winners and losers of the week, and value guests, thanks to Mr. Joe Reed, were the winner of this week's Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Bananas,
Sarah D. Bunting,
I never argue, I explain,
Joe Reed,
Justice for Laura Linney,
and Chris File.
What the fuck is Ozark?
What if, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Grade.
Half past eight. I must skedaddle.